Let's be real. Eating healthy can be a hassle. Stressing about nutrition, planning meals, shopping for ingredients. What if there was an easier way? Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your door. Each week, you can choose from a brand new selection of quick and easy meal kit recipes with a wide variety of dietary options, plus dozens of snacks, salads, breakfast items, and more. You can pick and choose from recipe options like vegetarian, Mediterranean, carb conscious, the list goes on. My family tested out the sirloin steak and the salmon last week, and it was a big winner at the dinner table. All of Sunbasket's meal kits are quick and easy, even if you're not a pro in the kitchen. Thanks to Sunbasket's commitment to clean ingredients and organic fresh produce, there's no easier way to eat your very best. Go to sunbasket.com/mindful today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/mindful to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Jillian Acosta, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you reached out to me and I saw words that always piqued my interest, functional nutrition. I feel like I've been on a never-ending journey of like figuring out to freaking eat just so I could feel my best. And I feel like I've made a ton of progress. And also I feel it's like you don't know what you don't know. Like, am I going to think the same way down the road? Your website, The Root Cause Method, that also piqued my interest because I feel like we're always asking the wrong questions. So we're always getting the wrong answers. You know, and the root cause, I assume you mean, you know, getting to the bottom of stuff when people don't feel well. Can you elaborate a little bit on what the root cause method means to you and maybe touch on what brought you to thinking that way?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I named my company The Root Cause Method because I was seriously inflamed. And I was like in my 20s, my mid-20s, I was inflamed. I got diagnosed with a thyroid condition. I had severe gastrointestinal issues. And at this point, I was already studying, you know, academically for what I'm doing now to become a dietitian. And I was eating a lot of the right things and, you know, super aware and all the things. And simultaneously, I had a very dysfunctional relationship with food. I had an emotional relationship with food. And so even though I knew what to be eating, anytime I was triggered or stressed or overwhelmed or whatever, I would reach for things outside of that. I would compulsively and just kind of in this like out of control energy, reach for the things that were soothing. And it was exacerbating my conditions. It was absolutely exacerbating both of the things I was trying to, you know, reverse and heal. And so in my mind, it was like, if I don't get this thing under control, if I don't address the root of what is driving this relationship with food, I'm never going to heal my body. And at the time, it was still unbeknownst to me, you know, that I had experienced severe complex trauma as a very young child, sexual abuse as like a very, very young child at 3 years old, 4 years old. And I didn't know. And it was repressed from my memory and all of that. And so I had this like this thing that was driving, you know, such a dysregulation in my nervous system, in my psyche. And I understood that the root cause of my condition was trauma, the root cause of so many people's chronic illness, you know, obesity and all the conditions that stem from weight-related illnesses. It's not you know, a Lipitor deficiency. It's not that they don't know what to eat. It's that there's something that is driving their behavioral choices around food 9 times out of 10, and that thing is trauma. And so that's why I named my business what I did. And you know, a lot of times, I don't want to put like a blanket statement, but a lot of people are dealing with like dysregulated nervous systems as a result of trauma. And the way that they try to regulate said nervous system is distraction, dissociation, food, any kind of comfort, narcotics, you know, all the things. We're very creative in the ways that we try to regulate. And food happens to be, you know, one of the most abused substances on the planet.
And also, thanks for sharing all that. Also, it makes you realize that because when you're under stress from a trauma or anything that's driving stress, you know the GI system is going to be affected. So it's reasonable to think that food should be the intervention to fix it, but it might not be really the lowest hanging fruit. You just don't know yet.
Yes, exactly. And what I'm really delving into now, after having exhausted all of the things, like psychedelics, I'm a big fan of. They helped me access what I accessed, and I use them, of course, therapeutically and with reverence. And even that type of like deep subconscious work led me to mineral rebalancing, because stress in the body absolutely depletes mineral status. And so you can do all the breath work, you could do all the biohacking, all the psychedelics in the world, but if your mineral status is like totally imbalanced and dysregulated and in the space where the minerals should be, now we have heavy metals, and now we have parasites and other conditions like H. pylori, like it's a mess. And so I'm going through this pretty incredible mineral rebalancing program where, as I dump metals, as my body purges metals, I'm also releasing insane amounts of trauma and emotional baggage, more than I've been able to in a lot of medicine work. It's wild.
Can you elaborate on that? You're saying that being under stress, trauma being, you know, a primary driver of stress, alters the mineral status in our body?
Absolutely. I mean, cortisol is stress hormone. It's correlated with survival. So like the body will always, biology will always prioritize survival beyond anything else, right? And so because it's linked to survival, because cortisol is linked to survival, when there's cortisol flooding the system, it gets first priority. It gets like first dibs on like the raw materials that it needs to like make more cortisol. Like the body will use the minerals. And so like magnesium status is completely depleted. Like the cortisol will steal the reserves. It will steal what the body has available to make more of itself so that we can survive. But it doesn't register that we're not actually running from a saber-toothed tiger, and we don't need to be in stress perpetually. And it's just this whole massive dysregulation that causes a lot of downstream ramifications, including the inability to like really actually regulate your nervous system. So you're perpetually in this like fight or flight sympathetic state and constantly reaching outside of yourself for that level of soothing. And oftentimes we reach for like surrogate forms of that that are costly and quite destructive.
So I want to touch on that just a little bit more, because I don't think I've heard this. So you're saying because cortisol goes up, the minerals that are needed in the synthesis of cortisol get... So in is magnesium related to that just because it's related to making energy in ATP, and it's a energetically expensive process to make cortisol?
To tell you the truth, I'm relatively new to the world of mineral balancing, so I could connect you with the person who you would love to talk to. But what I mean, magnesium is involved in like hundreds of biochemical processes, and I just know cortisol is a big robber of magnesium. Like it will use magnesium in the production of cortisol, the body will. And because we're prioritizing survival, that gets depleted. And then, you know, it's like the raw materials are being utilized. And so in other places where they're needed, they're not available. And that creates this imbalance. And yeah, it's just a scene.
You mentioned earlier that you had repressed memories that were, I guess, foundational to the issues that you were repressing were foundational to the health issues you had. It's interesting the way that our body can do that. Like you said, it's always prioritizing survival in some way. And it's like a feature and a bug, this ability to help you not remember. I remember thinking about this when my wife, Sarah, had her first child. I mean, at some point, like, I remember watching how seemingly miserable and painful the process that was. And it's like the body helps you forget the bad parts so that you'll do it again. So you'll sign up for round two, because obviously you need to make people to keep, you know, the species going. But it's similar. It's like in that, it's adjacent to that idea. Like, you have something really bad happen to you, and, you know, if you don't forget it at that time, at that age, then, you know, it could be, in the scheme of things, more problematic for your survival. So can you touch on that a little bit, and like what you, how you go about helping folks or yourself manage that?
Yeah, I love how you framed it as a feature and a bug. It's like, that's genius, because it is exactly that. And it's rooted so deeply, of course, in survival. And so it's like this incredible mechanism of the psyche that allows you to like totally dissociate and disconnect from like knowledge, experiences that would be catastrophic to the psyche of a child. Like, there's no way I would have been able to function normally or stayed in a dynamic, a familial or a environmental dynamic, to ensure my own belonging and survival if I was operating from the knowing of what I had experienced. So it was this compartmentalization of like allowing me to function somewhat normally in a very abnormal situation that allowed me to survive. And there was a huge cost associated. I had been carrying around the memory of this and the pain somatically in my tissue and my psyche forever. And so what that manifests as is like me needing to use a mechanism to push down the discomfort, the texture of a, like a memory that maybe reminded me of a threat or feeling unsafe or whatever. And every time I felt that way, it was like I cannot deal with this, because the memory of dealing with that was me needing to dissociate. So that's what I was repeating. And so, you know, In 2020, when I learned of this after 3 decades, it was pretty cataclysmic. It rocked me, honestly. And I was supported. And people that go through these big psychedelic experiences that don't have resources or support, that's dangerous. That's not ideal. You need that level of care and the ability to process and be held. And like, it's a very gradual process, but it ultimately was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was at such odds with myself. I had this level of like self-hatred and self-punishment, and would fall into like familiar patterns of like feeling as my worth was wrapped up in my appearance and my desirability towards men and you know, patterns of objectification and all the things that aren't true to me, that I was just repeating because they were in, that's what I was carrying energetically and from a, you know, space of memory. And so learning this was just really put me on the path of liberation. And I went into solitude for 2 years after that process started, and just really...
What do you mean solitude? Like, you live out in the woods on your own or off the grid, or what do you mean?
I had already launched my business, and actually I launched my business, a virtual business, but I remember I was so incredibly nauseous after learning what I had learned. It was like all this undigested emotion and energy that I had a trash can at my feet, a purge bucket at my feet, because I was like throwing up in between like calls with clients. I was so sick to my stomach, just releasing all this. And that was wild. But I would serve clients virtually, but I had no social interaction, no social engagement. I went into like a portal, a hole. Even from family, like, I was just in such an incredible process. It felt like a chrysalis, honestly. It felt like I was in a chrysalis. I was like decomposing into goo, totally like just falling apart in all the ways that I had known myself and seen myself. And in that decomposition was like truth and like the depth of like courage I have and strength I have. And in that sacred space, I started to like make these connections and harvest this wisdom that became very clear that I'm meant to share this with other people, because I know I'm not the only one on this path, or even like a similar path. And so, yeah, it just fueled me and strengthened me and forged me. And now I'm like, I'm really grateful for the wisdom, because I witness women and some men, honestly, walking the path of self-liberation. And it's just epic. It lights me up.
Nice. From the wound comes the gift.
Always.
You alluded to the psychedelic experience. Was that like that the catalyst that was allowed you to remember the trauma?
Yeah, it was gnarly. I mean, I wasn't being re-traumatized. It was really gentle in the delivery. It was just freaking bizarre. And I really didn't know how to hold it and kind of was, you know, in an unsupported way, to tell you the truth, in the beginning when I first learned. And I was married at the time, and like that kind of helped me. That first experience, I always say, like, it made it really hard for me to continue to lie to myself. I didn't even recognize myself in the mirror. I was so, like, taken by, I don't even know. It wasn't me. It was this mask and this facade that I had built to try to survive. And so I left the marriage and launched my business in the same month. And after I had launched my business and moved out, I started to use food again to regulate my system, because all of a sudden I was alone and I was now supporting myself financially. I just graduated from school, so I hadn't been working before that. And, you know, all of this like unfamiliar territory, like my cue is like when I don't feel stable and sturdy, I'm reaching for food. And so I started to do that, and I started to notice, and I listened. I'm like, what's the call? What am I supposed to be doing right now? And I heard very strongly to sit with the medicine again. And so I went back and I sat in another ayahuasca experience. And that's when everything like blasted out of Pandora's box. And that's when I was more supported and resourced. And that's when I, you know, really plunged myself onto this path. But yeah, it was extraordinary.
Sounds it. What kind of foods were you reaching towards?
Oh my God. Ice cream, cookies, like sweets, chocolate, salt and vinegar chips, like just all the processed crappy stuff that would like light up my brain and create that like that soothing feeling. I mean, the reality is like that's what I was reaching for.
I wonder. I mean, I've been learning a lot about metabolism over the last couple of years. And like you mentioned cortisol earlier, and it seems like we're always trying to meet the demands of energy with some supply of energy. And these stress hormones are trying to help that. And our body really likes the energy from glucose that we get. And it's like we have these hormones to help you get energy when you're not getting enough. So I wonder if some of those raw feelings are useful to get sugar, like because there's like an anti-stress effect of it. And we feel, but now it's hard. Like a lot of sugar comes in the form of like, with all kinds of crap on it, like a Kit Kat bar or something. But, you know, it's funny because when women are pregnant, the people around them will want to feed their cravings. Like, get that woman some pickles, get her some ice cream, whatever. Like, the village is like, this woman needs this thing. Can't you hear what she's asking for? But in non-pregnant context, it's like vilified, your cravings. But, like, maybe those cravings are smarter than you think. It's like your body asking for something, but we're so bad at listening.
Yeah. And, you know, I teach a lot about the difference between physical and emotional hunger. You know, to your point earlier, like I wasn't in a caloric deficit and I was reaching for those things. You know what I mean? Like, and I was reaching for those things. It had nothing to do with like my actual like needs or like my brain needing glucose. It was supplied. And like, no, I was carrying a lot of excess weight. I was super inflamed. Like it was absolutely driven by the emotion. And what it feels like is an emotional hijack. It's like, I have to eat those cookies. Like, I have to. It's those chips, you know, whereas physical hunger, you're like, you open the fridge and there's all these options. And you're like, I think I'll have my leftover turkey, whatever the hell, you know, like, but emotionally, it's like that thing is going to do it. It's almost like a hit of something, you know, narcotics or whatever. And so it was that. It was just like, it was emotional hunger. It was like this deep emptiness that I was trying to fill that was unfillable. and I didn't even know what it was. And, you know, it's an epic distraction because, you know, you can finish the pint of ice cream, but the thing doesn't go away. But what happens is you enter into a space of like physical discomfort, you know, you feel really crappy. Maybe you're bloated, you have GI distress, whatever it is. And mentally, you're in like a shame spiral. So you're taken away from the initial trigger, you're distracted temporarily. And then once you digest and kind of move through the cycle, maybe you go to bed, you wake up the next morning, it's another day. The thing remains, the driver, the activator, the trigger in which you're trying to soothe with food or whatever is still there. And so you're just in this like runaround with yourself. And so my, like, if I had to kind of surmise my work into like one sentence or phrase, it's that I help create and cultivate safety within an individual so that they can feel. Because when you feel safe to feel an emotion, you no longer need anything to numb it. And so I witness, you know, physiology changing, the remission of conditions, people getting off medication, mobility increasing, all these kinds of things, not because of a rigid diet, but because they've created a safe space within themselves to move through an emotion, embodied, learn from it potentially, like release it, whatever. And then they no longer, like the cookies are no longer yelling, you know, like the thing loses its charge. Because the thing that you want the cookies to numb has already been felt. You don't need to numb it.
So then how is it different for you now? Like you already alluded, you had a couple, I guess, defined, I guess, health complications when you were in your mid-20s, you said. Something thyroid related, I think you said gut health related.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been both like, so functionally, like from a clinical standpoint, so like, the things, I don't eat gluten in this country, for example. So I've addressed it, attacked it kind of from many different angles. So there is like a nutrition component, there's supplementation, but I've gone into remission with both gut stuff and thyroid, but in conjunction with a lot of emotional processing. You know, I kind of combined a lot of modalities into my work, and one of them is like, you know, the knowledge of energetics and how the body somatically stores and stores and holds trauma. And so like, it's no coincidence that I had issues in my thyroid, because this is like the throat. It's responsible for like speaking boundaries and yelling and crying out for help and speaking my truth and communicating my feelings. And I was stuffing food down the same exact energy center and punishing myself with purging. I was bulimic, you know? And so it was this, all of this like energy in the throat. Of course I had a thyroid condition at 25 years old. And same with the gut. The gut is the emotional brain, and all this unprocessed trauma was like amassing in my gut. So I was bloated and I was constipated and I was just like holding, couldn't let go because I didn't know how, I didn't know what. And so it was all these conditions, like the body is so brilliant, is always communicating. It's just like sometimes we view it strictly through a scientific lens and we miss all this like the backstory, you know, and sometimes it's too much of the energetics and the woo when we miss like the clinical component and what to actually do to eradicate and the interventions needed. And so I feel fortunate that, you know, my path has allowed me to learn so many of these modalities and combine them into this thing that I do, that I get to witness people healing all the time. It's awesome.
So what do you recommend? Like, what, let's say somebody comes to you and maybe they do have gut issues and they're backed up, or they have thyroid issues, they have like low energy, or I don't know, dry skin or losing hair, whatever the symptoms related to that are, and they don't want to take ayahuasca, like they're scared to death of that, or what other modalities that do you lean on?
So it's great. I have a program that I offer in my work called The Garden, and this is like probably my signature program. It's deep dive. It's like one-on-one for 13 weeks. And in the beginning, I'm analyzing data. So it's either a stool sample or maybe dried urine if they've got hormonal issues, or blood chemistry. And I'm creating a protocol and intervention based on their unique physiology. And I'm giving them a structure. It's both, you know, supplementation, it's dietary, it's of course lifestyle, it's all these kinds of things to help support the body and the systems that are imbalanced. And then we do deep dive work into the emotions and the psychology of eating that had them get to that imbalanced state. And so a lot of my work is like, it's experiential. I'm talking about concepts, but I'm guiding them back into their body like every single call. And so in the creating a safe space for them to come back into the body and feel, because people that have abused food or other substances live dissociated, they're kind of disembodied, it hasn't felt safe for them to feel or to come back in their body, I'm guiding them back into their body. And so other modalities that I use is like visualization, but a lot of somatic experiencing. I use a lot of parts work. And in my work, I don't facilitate medicine ceremonies with ayahuasca or mushrooms or anything like that, but I do use a psychedelic called ketamine. And everything is above ground, and they get a prescription, and I am facilitating and guiding those experiences.
Parts work. Where did you learn all that stuff? Is that like the IFS stuff? For the listeners, IFS, that's internal family systems. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I kind of put my own little twist on it. I use it a lot, but I put my own little twist on it. And, you know, like in parts work, there's like the protector and the perfectionist and the judge, and they're kind of like all kind of compartmentalized parts, and that's beautiful and helpful. But what I see is like this conglomerate of parts, and I call it part X. And it's like all of those parts that are tethered to your pain, the one that tells you you got to eat the cookies because you can't feel, the one that tells you if the guy leaves you, you're unworthy, the one that tells you like you should hide because you don't look good enough, so you shouldn't go to the beach. Like, it's all of that. That's part X. And so we work with part, we define her or him, we get to know that part. And in the learning and the exploration, the curiosity of this part, we get to see that we've subscribed to that as who we are, and that's not who we are. There becomes this gap. Like, you can observe this part, meaning that's not you. And so what I love about this work and this deep dive, especially with the use of ketamine, which is the medicine that I use in my practice, is that ketamine it's a psychedelic. It's an FDA-approved psychedelic, so they get a prescription. It's all above ground. It's all legal. But it still induces an altered state of consciousness. You know, 95% of trauma is stored in the subconscious mind. Trauma is stored in the subconscious mind, and 95% of our behavior is driven by the subconscious mind. So I see trauma as like this puppet master, and like we're on the strings. And if we want foundational, like deep root cause healing, body, mind, soul, all the things, then we need to like get acquainted with the puppet master, like who is driving the ship here. And ketamine and other psychedelic medicines give us that capacity. But what I love about ketamine is that it's very gentle. It's gentle and it's heart opening. So unlike ayahuasca, whom I have deep reverence for, but can be very confronting and abstract and take you into like the depths of the shadow land, and if you don't know how to navigate that, it could be a lot. Ketamine is not that. It's very, very heart opening and gentle. And so it's also a sub anesthetic dissociative. So it gives someone the opportunity, for example, they may be in an experience and a wave of fear comes. And instead of being taken by the fear and like resisting the fear because it's scary and it's too much, what that experience or this medicine allows is someone to be like, oh, wow, like this is what fear feels like. Wow. Okay. It allows you to like explore it. Oh, I can be with this. I can breathe with this. And my favorite part about this is like in real time, their capacity of being with something uncomfortable expands. And we nurture the hell out of that in outside of medicine space. And that becomes like a new neural pathway. That becomes a new capacity that they can now have because they've done it already. It's like, oh, I remember being with fear last time I was in medicine. I know what it feels like now. I can be with this thing. I don't have to go eat a bunch of cookies or pizza or whatever to like push this thing down. I now am capable. And that creates a sense of self-efficacy. And that is just like, that gives people the tools to move through anything. And that's deeply empowering and liberating.
That sounds really interesting. I personally have not tried ketamine. What's the delivery method you're using for that?
Troches. So it's like troches or troches or what? It's like a lozenge, and it doesn't taste very great, but it's like this rubbery, plasticky thing you stick between your cheek and your gum, and it dissolves. It usually takes like 10 minutes for the onset. The whole process is like an hour, hour and a half, depending on how you metabolize. And those calls that I offer in this program are around 3 hours. And so we're spending the first 30 minutes, like, I treat it like a ceremony.
Okay, so this is done virtually. So someone's in their home, put a thing in their mouth. 10 minutes later, their inhibitions have dropped. Their conscious mind is getting out of the way so that the subconscious can invited or explored with less like judgment. Or that's interesting. Do you get anybody that when they, if they're not used to an altered state, they freak out? When never.
And I'm there. And so like I've had people experience fear, and what's so magical is because like I'm there, so energetic, I'm attuned, but I'm also like really, really intuitive. And if they speak that, which I can even feel in their body language or their face or whatever, I can help bring them through the fear. So they're not like alone in that, and they know how to navigate it instead of like running and resisting it. It's an incredible opportunity of like deep healing. There's always an emotional release, and like they move through it instead of like running away from it and contracting. There's always an expansion. But it's because it's the gentle nature of it, you're not like, not thrust into like the underworld.
Okay. Are there any risks that you know of with that stuff, or?
Uncontrolled hypertension. If someone has really high blood pressure and it's not managed, that's the only risk. I mean, this is used in the hospitals all.
Do you know why that is? Is it like a vasoconstrictor or something, or?
Oh man, I should know this. I don't think it creates vasoconstriction. I don't know. I'll find out. I should know that, but I don't. Nobody, and they're always, anyone who goes through this process is cleared medically. It's a prescription that they're receiving. So they're going through an intake process.
Personal doc first.
No, I have referrals. I'll send them to referrals, either a physician in their state or one of the at-home ketamine companies like, you know, MindBloom New Life. So they go through their medical intake process. And then I'm really just like holding space. I'm really just facilitating the experience. They don't touch this medicine until 5 weeks into the program. So there is a lot of pre-support. Yeah, there's a lot of pre-support, during support, and then post-integration support.
Interesting. You mentioned post-integration. Because we had someone on recently, Daniel Rosenberg, that does somatic experiencing. And I guess he picked apart an experience I had where maybe I like left that part out, where I had like this amazing breakthrough and my body changed over it. And then a couple weeks later, it just kind of creeped back. And he's like, never like re-channeled that life energy. So it kind of went, it did the same thing it always knows to do. It went to like the same body part that it always knows, knew.
Have you ever heard of the book, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan?
I have, yeah.
It's a fantastic book. And one of my favorite analogies that he shares in that is that like, you know, trauma and like, thought patterns and all these things are like deeply grooved neural pathways that kind of represent like ski grooves on a busy day in a mountain, right? And like the grooves are so you can just like fall back into the grooves. But a psychedelic experience with proper integration and all the things is like a fresh coat of snow. So if you don't put something kind of on top of that with like new practices, I think, you know, I was told that massive transformation, like in terms of psychedelics, 2% happens in the psychedelic experience, and 98% of it is really integration. It is the creation of a new psychological, emotional infrastructure in the psyche. And so if you're not, you know, creating new pathways, your brain just by default will go back to the old ones because those are the ones that are deeply grooved and practiced. And so that's, I take integration very, very seriously.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You said some words earlier that were great. You were talking about part X, like the lumping of all the different parts. And you said tethered to your pain, like the parts that are tethered to your pain, as if like the pain is where it's all derived from. And then I guess these processes, whether they're with psychoactive compounds or not, are there to facilitate this untethering where you could see like you're not that, or that's not you, and you could differentiate them and be okay with that and explore whatever you want it to mean for you, like, or so that it could be repurposed or reserved.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest tragedies is like, I see this part X is like this mask, and like, because it's so stuck to our faces, we're looking out of the eye holes. And so we think it's us. We are identifying with it because we can't see, there's nothing else to see. We just see through the lens of that. But my work is really about is like peeling away like the mask and being able to like, I'm now seeing it. meaning I'm not that. The tragedy is that we've identified as that. I thought I was worthless. I thought I was powerless. That's the pain I was in when this part came online. When I was a child, I was powerless. I was a victim. So I thought that I was a victim. I operated as powerless. I was powerless to the freaking crackers in the pantry. I was powerless if a man was interested in me and I wasn't interested in him. Like, I didn't know that that wasn't me. And so my work is like pulling away the self-construct that we've identified as. And that means all of a sudden of like, well, if that's not me, then like, who the hell am I? And it gets really, really exciting because then it's like this discovery and this remembrance and this creation of like, well, who, if I'm not that, who do I desire to be? Who's my, what's my truth? And it's transformational and exciting and, again, liberating.
Cool stuff. I'm going to take a couple further steps back. And I know you're educated in like nutrition and dietary work. And you mentioned some of the processes that you do during that 13-week thing. And I think a couple of the first things you said was stool testing. I think you said dried urine. Did I hear that right? Is dried urine have benefits as opposed to the wet stuff?
Yeah, there's a test out there called the Dutch test. The lab is Precision Analytics or Precision Analytical. And this is for people with like hormonal imbalance, issues with cortisol, the adrenals, like all of these things. And the reason why dried urine is favorable is because dried urine passes through all the excretory like processes. Like, so you're getting the metabolites of the hormone. I get to see which pathway, for example, estrogen can go down three major pathways, two of which are deeply toxic and carcinogenic. So I get to see in what percentages, you know, estrogen is taking which pathway. You know, I get to see fluctuations or patterning in the way that these hormones are metabolized in the body. And that is really insightful. Super insightful.
So that's useful. And then you'll make a dietary change based on what's in the...
Yeah, no, entire intervention. So supplementation, dietary changes, but also lifestyle, you know, morning ritual. I'm a huge proponent of morning practice, daily practice.
Touch on that. What do you recommend or what do you do personally?
What I do personally is every single day I sit in front of my altar and I go into a breath practice and then a meditation and usually journaling. And it's a 30-minute practice. And it's just me getting in my body. It's me connecting with myself and in the sacred, listening, expressing. Oftentimes in breath, I make sound, just opening and sounding. And like, and the coolest thing about this, and it's quite tantric, but it's like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to do that. What changed the game for me was when I like brought in the resistance into my practice. And so I give myself a chance to like feel the resistance. What does resistance sound like? You know, like how would my body move and sound if resistance is moving through me?
Do you mean like resistance, like not wanting to spend the 30 minutes to sit and do that? Is that what you're...
Yeah. If I'm like, I don't feel like it, I'm not in the mood, like there's resistance, like bring that into your practice and like express, let that express through you. You know, if you're tired, like bring the tiredness in. If you're full of like, you know, if you're like irritable and like cranky, like bring that in to the practice, feel that, be with that, sound as that. And so in the no matter whatness, you're creating space for yourself. For me, on like a subconscious level, honoring myself and this commitment every day has told myself subconsciously, I'm worthy of that. I'm showing myself my own worthiness by following through every day when I'm in the mood or when I'm not. And because I've created this space for myself, I receive guidance. My intuition is strong. Like I get creative downloads. I get, if I'm moving through a process, which I feel like I always am, I get clarity. I get emotional releases. I get to come back into my body. It's just like all across the board, like my life works really well when I'm doing this, and it just does not go well when I don't.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when you just make space for the stuff to come up, you know, just make a little space. It doesn't take a lot of time, but it's hard. It's very hard for people to get over that hump, that initial, like, I'm going to make time and sit down to have that make space. So you get up, that's the first thing you do, basically?
I pee, and I sit. I scrape my tongue. I pee, I scrape my tongue. You know, I brush my teeth, and then I sit. I don't make a coffee. I just sit because my altar is kind of my bedroom, and I have like a this really cool little sacred room with like a window on the ceiling that's beautiful oak tree. Like, it's just a sacred space, and so I don't even have the opportunity to go downstairs. I sit, and I don't always want to. I'm not always in the mood. I want to hang out with my boyfriend, or I want to whatever the hell, and I do it anyway. Because it's like, I have to come first. I have to come first. And then from that space, I serve other. Like, I'm serving people all day. And I'm not talking about, you know, eat broccoli sprouts. I'm talking about, like, what happened in your childhood that has you hate yourself. Like, it's deep, you know? And so if I don't create the space for myself, I'm no good for anyone else. I'm not, my mirror is not clear, you know? And so I do.
What other, like, routines do you have that are, like, the staples of your...
I move my body every day. I'll go to the gym and do resistance training probably 4 or 5 days a week. And then if I'm not doing that, I'm walking. I also have a like a standing desk with a treadmill underneath it. And so when I'm on calls with clients, I'm walking at like a 1.3 speed, but I'm not sedentary. I mean, I have a lot of staples in terms of diet, nutrition that I'm happy to share.
Go for it. I love to hear what people... Do. It seems like you've made big positive adjustments to your health. So I think there's a lot for people to learn from.
Yeah, I'm a big protein pusher. I'm a big fan of protein, high quality beef, high quality eggs, all grass fed, grass finished, pasture raised. I'll spend money on animal protein because I think that the conventional stuff is absolutely catastrophically toxic. And I just have no room for it. So we don't. I live in Austin, and so there are restaurants that offer like grass-fed burgers and stuff like that. But if we're not eating at one of those kinds of places, we cook. We don't eat out. So we're both really like we go to farmers markets every Saturday and get all the good stuff. And, you know, it's a little bit more money, but what you're actually investing in is the health of your body. And so like what do you have if you don't have your health? You don't have anything. So protein first thing in the morning. He makes an incredible bone broth. It's like to die for. So I usually start my day with a cup of broth and an infrared sauna. And I'm sitting in there for the first, like after my meditation, like I wake up at 7 and I don't take my first client until like 10:30. And so like the morning is mine and it's all mine. And I'm doing whatever the hell. I am so selfish and it's so good. And I serve at a high capacity and this is how I do it. It's like I have to take care of myself, and the surface is the overflow. You know, I served in another way. This is like 4 or 5 years in now, and I have been burnt out and depleted. I was taking like 7 calls a day, like, you know, just grinding, and I wasn't good for my people, you know, and these people are coming to me vulnerable and investing in themselves and like, you know, open and ready, and I have to show up. Like, I really hold what I do with like with deep care, and so I take the space. I take a lot of space for myself to care for myself so I can show up for them. And so it's broth. It's.
Do you feel like when you're sitting with people that are working through trauma and shitty experiences of their past, like, do you tend to like take that on? Are you good at like differentiating that energy or disassociating it so that it doesn't like creep into you?
Yeah, I think to a degree I've been in medicine and I've felt the stickiness of a certain client, and like so there could be a level of exposure that I'm, but I think the virtual nature of my work is a barrier that protects me for sure, but also because my approach to my work is so compassionate, like heavy, I am in such honor and compassion and permission and acceptance of every person. There's not judgment. If I were to judge, that's when I would stick to the energy. If it's like judge and fear and whatever, that's when the energy gets sticky. But if it's loving, everything can be held and healed in love. And so I feel like I'm not a match for the density on an energetic level. There's no affinity. There's no compatibility. So I am not like sticking to the energy that we're working with. I'm holding it in love and it's being transmuted. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's...
Sure. I mean, if that's what works for you. I remember I had an experience. I was like 21 years old. I was working at this crazy job. It was different lifetime ago. And I witnessed one of my coworkers had like a migraine, and there was this woman, I forget where she was, I think some Eastern European country, that she hadn't been here that long. And she like was like, let me help you. And she went over, and I had never witnessed any kind of, like, I don't know what would be considered alternative, but yeah, gift is what it turned out to be. And, you know, maybe in hindsight, it was a form of Reiki of some sort, but it wasn't, though. But she basically put her hands around this woman's head, and in a few minutes, I mean, the woman who was, you know, a very serious, down-to-earth person, couldn't believe her migraine was gone. But I watched the woman that provided the gift. She looked like her fingers were in excruciating pain afterwards. And I watched it. She had to go like wash her hands and shake her hands off. And then after a few minutes, like, she was fine. I was like, oh, it was interesting. Like, that was the first exposure I've ever had to someone try some kind of like human to human healing modality. And, I remember someone else was like, we got a gypsy in the house. Or so, like, she was being, like, made fun of by other people that worked there. And I was just, like, kind of blown away. The fact that I thought it was cool that she helped the person, but I found it really interesting that her hands hurt, like, as if she took it on. And I guess maybe that comes in different forms. But if you're listening to people uncover, you know, really crappy situations of their past, like, it's got to be, for some people, I think that'd be really hard to do, to not carry that.
It is. And I mean, honestly, I think I'm speaking from the lens of like now, but I had to learn how to do that, because just thinking about a couple of years ago, absolutely, I would feel this density and I would go into a practice and I would try to like clear the energy in there. You know, yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do that. But yeah, you're right. I was taking it on more so in the beginning than I am now. And I think I've like learned how to not do that as much, which
that's its own skill. You sharpen that tool.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Back to the routine. So you went over, you have a pretty extensive morning routine, which is great, which some folks, you know, that might sound really luxurious and they might feel like, you know, the average person juggling maybe a couple kids and job or two. What other routines that you have? Like, do you have one before bed or some other time during the day? Or
I want to speak to the person who's juggling kids and has like a hectic life real quick, because I'm sure they hear me and they're like, wow, what privilege, like, how it must be nice. And I don't have children yet. And so I'm sure that when I do, my life will and my routine will look very different. So I totally honor that. And it's like 10 minutes is always available. And what that could look like is like putting your feet in the grass for 10 minutes and just sipping your coffee while you stand there and ground. First thing in the morning, getting sunlight in your eyes, kind of waking up, you know, the cortisol awakening, activating response, like getting that to start your day is massive and beneficial and doesn't take as long, and you don't need 3 hours in the morning to do it. And granted, my whole 3 hours is not like me, you know, doing all those routine things. I'm working, I'm doing podcasts and whatever is on the agenda, but I take for sure the first hour of like dedicated space, solo time, and then I kind of come out of my hole and meet the world and meet the day. And nighttime, we have red lights in our house, and so we shut off all LED lights. I'm not on my phone for like 2 hours before bed, and we walk around with red light. And not as often as I would love, but probably like three nights a week, we're in that sacred space and we're stretching. So we'll put on some like cool, like vibey, like slow music, and just both drop into our bodies with like a foam roller or stretching, and just like real like somatic unwinding, relaxation before bed. And then I'm reading, or we chat, but there's no electronics, and just like mellow. The dogs are hanging out with us and it's just like slow, and then we drift off to sleep.
That sounds nice. I have a recent problem I'm up against, and I have like a similar approach to evening routine. I do the red lights and chill out and stretch. And my amazing wife, who I love dearly. It has a new addiction, relatively new addiction of crochet.
Oh, wow.
And she's sitting in bed and she has like this little light on to help her see. And she can't really do it well with the red light because she can't differentiate like the colors of the... So this is like a new phenomenon in our house. We're like, we have to be able to reconcile this because I'm not like messing with my circadian rhythm for your sweater. There probably is a 2% chance you're ever going to wear. So we're, because she's still, you know, new at it, though she is learning fast and making some pretty cool stuff. So that's like the current negotiation going on. Yeah. We'll find a solution, but.
Some blue blocking glasses. If I do have to be on, I wear these blue blockers that are, they're pretty rad. They're great.
Yeah, they work. I mean, that's an underrated tool. Like, I think I've recommended them many times over the years to clients and they work. I mean, it might take a few days for them to start working, but they work. And what's nice about them is, I guess, you don't have to worry about other people's decisions as much because you're like, your protection is close to you. They do work. Well, we went over a lot of stuff today. So you offer one-on-one stuff where you look at people's dry pee, among other things. And what other services do you provide? Do you have any group work? Is it all one-on-one?
Yeah. So I have another program called Wildflower. It's actually launched. It's going on right now. This is an 8-week program exclusively for women, while the garden is like any human, any gender. Wildflower is exclusive for women on the path of emotional eating. And it's potent because it offers something the garden can't. You know, when women come together in support of one another and like you're willing to be seen in safe community and safe spaces, that is where shame dies. That is where stories are transmuted. It is just its own force of medicine that is so potent and awesome. And so, yeah, there's one going on right now. I'm so lit up by group work. I know that this is like deeply how I'm here to serve. And so the next cohort starts in January.
How many women at a time are we talking about?
Sometimes it's like 15. It's always intimate, usually no more than 15, 20. Sometimes they're smaller. But as more people get exposed to my work, I think that it will start to fill out a little bit more, but I'll keep it capped around that 15, 20 women at a time.
Do you feel that for some people that just works better than the one-on-one because...
Yeah, there's a lot of people that have done a lot of one-on-one work. There's a lot of therapized people out there. And while this is not technically therapy and my approach is very different, that kind of work can never offer what group offers. You know, a lot of people, myself, you know, I created both of these programs because it's what I needed when I was suffering. And one of the things that I was suffering so badly with was like, I was alone. I was isolated. I was totally alone before solitude. That was healing. But like in my life, I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't know how to connect to people. I had so much shame that I didn't even know that I stayed isolated. I was ashamed of my body. I hid. I said I missed out on opportunities. I didn't have a best friend or any people to share my things with. And I now know that's what, you know, treatment did for me. When I went to treatment for bulimia, that was probably the biggest benefit, was that I met other women who were struggling and knew what I was going through. They knew the crazy thoughts I was having. They knew the world of this, and they could relate to me like a therapist couldn't, like a parent couldn't, like no one could. And so having that community was so supportive, which is why I created Wildflower.
And is that like a once a week kind of online?
It's a once a week for 8 weeks, 2-hour live calls. And so there's an arc, there's modules every week. There's like written material, but there's also like specific like journal prompts and activities that help support whatever we talk about in each week. So it's structured. And there's also a lot of opportunity for like live sharing. So there's activities that we do. There's an activity with food where everyone comes to the call with food. And I don't want to say anything more about it because it's really powerful and juicy. So if anyone's want to sign up, I don't want to give it away. But there's like things we do each week. And then there's also a lot of time for like sharing, because the medicine is being willing to be seen, you know, showing yourself in your pain, in your shame, being seen in that, and then being so held and loved through it. That's when things are transmuted. And like, yeah, those stories go.
Yeah. Working with shame is very powerful. I know personally, I've experienced history of some of that around different issues. And it's just a tough one that grabs people in a way that you don't know how it's affecting you. until, you know, and it is a low frequency to be riding on. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's part X. It's all part X. It's that. And so it's like, can you create a little bit of separation to like see the pain that's driving the narrative and then meet yourself in that pain, grieve, rage it, like be held in it, hold yourself in it, and let it start to dissipate, and also recognize that that's not you.
It seems, Jillian, that you pull from a lot of different modalities that you've picked up over the years. Are there certain influences that stand out to you that you recommend people to read, or like podcasts to listen to? Or
There's an incredible book that I recommend deeply that I've woven into my work called Mother Hunger by Kelly McDaniel. And she talks about the mother wound. And she talks about it from the lens of the daughter. But I also have had men read this book because I think it's applicable to men. I think it's applicable to all. I think we all have a degree of the mother wound and how we seek surrogate forms of nurturance in things like food or, you know, maybe unhealthy relationships or substances or whatever. So I'm a huge fan of her work.
Wait, the mother wound, what does that refer to? Just like the separation of the mother or the...
What her work says is, and that I agree with wholeheartedly, is that there's like three primary roles of the mother. It's nurturance, guidance, and protection. And when the mother is incapable, physically or emotionally incapable of providing those qualities, those things to the child, the needs don't go away. We have a biological need to receive nurturance and safety, protection from the mother. And so when she fails for whatever reason, not because she's bad or wrong, but because she couldn't, the need remains. And so that's what creates this driver to reach outside of ourselves biologically to meet that need. We are brilliant at that. We will find a way to get that, even if it's a surrogate form, even if it's like a Band-Aid, just as like, you know, cookies are. I keep saying cookies. They're on my mind, apparently. Like, you know, and so... It's like a hunger. We hunger for that nurturance. We hunger for that comfort. We hunger for that feeling of safety and protection. And when we lack that, that's what creates the susceptibility to go find it in costly ways. And yeah, and it's powerful work, the mother wound. And, you know, going a little deeper and a little bit more esoteric, like, you know, think about if your mother didn't offer you those things and so there was a lack of that. And maybe the way that she showed up was, I'll speak from my own example. My mom was deeply unconscious, totally riddled with her own trauma, very deeply in her masculine expression or wounded masculine expression. So she was like, she was the breadwinner of the household. And she was, you know, very shaming and very cold and not nurturing and all these other things. And so it's like, if she wasn't giving me the nurturance and then that's what she was giving me, there was this deep and like inherent distrust in her, but who she represents, my first exposure is the feminine. She's the feminine. And so if there's a distrust with the feminine, there that's going to manifest in my body where I don't trust the feminine expression, which is the emotion, feelings. You know, I'm not going to trust my own intuition, my body. Those are all feminine. And it also is showing up in the planet. There's a wound with there's this disregard, there's this diminishment of the feminine in Mother Earth. I mean, it's pervasive in a patriarchal society that we live in. And so it's like healing the relationship we have with ourselves and our own femininity through this kind of work has this incredible ripple effect where now we are more connected, we can follow intuition, we are embodied, we have power back. And a woman in her power doesn't lead by dominance. A woman in her power leads through love and compassion and honor. It's the matriarchal way. It's the all of us included way instead of the patriarchal way, which looks like power over. It's not anything wrong with men or masculine. It's just the wounded expression of power. And so like bringing the feminine back online in all beings is like benefits the world.
That's an interesting juxtaposition there. Yeah, I could see a lot of truth in what you just said there. Anything else you would like to add, Jillian, before we wrap this up?
Current health status, right? Not you, but like in general, people that are carrying excess weight, people that have conditions, people that are that are frustrated with themselves and feel disempowered and frustrated. They've tried all the diets. Nothing is working. They're carrying around weight. They're inflamed. They're unhappy. All the things. Like, it has nothing to do with who they are and their character or their willpower, their discipline, their capacity. Nothing. It has everything to do with what they experienced. Weight is pain stored in the body. Weight is armor. You are shielding yourself from feeling pain. That is what it is. And so my invitation is really, like, approach this from a compassionate lens of being curious around what happened to you, instead of carrying shame and judgment towards, you know, the manifestation of it.
I think that's great advice. I want to thank you for taking the time. I'm glad you guys reached out to us. You seem to have found the thing that you should be doing now.
Thank you.
The passion radiates off, and honored to be a conduit for your message and for the listeners. I hope you got some value out of this. And if you think you know somebody that would enjoy the conversation, please share it. Always grateful for your listening. Jillian, grateful for you taking the time. And I hope our paths cross again sometime. I hope everybody has a great day.